From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
Welcome to Voices of the Royal Pavilion Museums and to the final series of this podcast. As with the first two series, I'll be taking you behind the scenes at Brighton & Hove's five-site museum service, meeting some of the walking encyclopedias that make up its workforce. Before we begin, I need to address the fact that the world as we knew it has changed exponentially since these interviews took place in 2019. The coronavirus pandemic and its effects on our health, our livelihoods and our communities has had a huge knock-on impact for cultural and heritage organisations such as Royal Pavilion and Museums Brighton and Hove. For all of us in the museum sector, the future is uncertain. The passion and enthusiasm of staff that you will hear in this podcast and the crucial role of stories and cultural objects in how we make sense of our world are precisely why we must continue to fight for the value of heritage institutions in the new reality that we are facing. While the interviews in this podcast don't address our new circumstances, I'm going to try my utmost to frame their significance around what has now occurred. And with that said, in this episode, I'll be trying to understand the delicate, painstaking and surprisingly creative work undertaken by conservators at Royal Pavilion and Museums, so as to better grasp what it takes to keep its collection in tip-top shape for the public and for the future.
I'm a paper conservator. My name's Amy Juncker-Heslip, and I've worked at the RPM for almost 5 years this November. And I look after basically all things paper for all the sites. And that can involve wallpaper, works of art on paper, prints, drawings, photographs, you name it, archives, anything else. I can't think of anything else. Just anything with paper on it. Recently, my job's expanded a little bit, so I also look after the disaster and salvage plan for all sites, and sort of half a day a week on the pavilion, which could be anything, glass cleaning, chandelier cleaning, and yeah, anything else that needs doing.
The disaster and salvage plan?
Yes.
For anyone not in the know, that sounds really extreme. What does that mean exactly?
Every institution around the UK needs to have a business continuity plan, so a plan of what would happen if there was a power cut or, you know, a flood. And also on top of that, we have like an instant response plan, and that's what you do with the collection should something adverse happen to it. That will tell you sort of the plan of what you do if there's a fire or flood, and different teams in the organisation, and how you might go into the building and remove the object. So that's called the salvage, and then how you would save it. That's called the recovery aspect. So how would sort of the concept, the first aid treatments that you might do straight away or the treatments you might do later on. It involves writing the plan, but it also involves getting kits, so little trolleys. We've got all the different sites, so you can wheel them out if there's a small incident, or we've got larger supplies in all the sites as well of plastics and blotting paper and some tools, and then PPE, we call it, personal protective equipment. We've got all that at all the sites. And also we do training, so we train people how to, in teams, handle, remove objects. And then we do a little bit of triage. So I've bought a load of things from charity shops not real objects that we wet up, and we learn how to lay them out and dry them, because you wouldn't believe, like, a small stack of archives, when you are spreading them out to dry them, they take up so much space, and it's a really good exercise for people to see how overwhelming it can be if there's even a small flood in a building. So we do a little bit of that training. We've had quite a lot of local disasters in the recent years. There was a National Trust property in the southeast was hit by a major fire that gutted the entire building. So it really brings home that these things can happen. And we also had, there was a fire in the National Gallery of Brazil in Glasgow, in the Cumin Museum in central London. So a lot of the places, such as the National Trust, had a really robust salvage plan. They managed to get a lot of the objects out of the building. But it reminds you that you have to keep on top of these things, to keep training and keep up to date with everything. That's one day a week.
That's one day a week. I want to rewind a little bit. What took you into paper conservation in the first place?
I was just thinking to myself that we're a really small team at the RPM, and there's one painting conservator, one paper conservator, and one object conservator, and we're not only one of us is full time. But the object conservator, I think that's the worst title ever, because an object could be anything 3D. So paper is slightly easier. When paper, you know that it's generally artwork or archive based. But yeah, poor Andy has a bit of a task. When anything is 3D, we sort of point at him, poor thing. So I did a degree in art history, and then I, as everyone does, I think, you know, you don't really know what you're going to do. And I had a few years travelling around, and then I landed in Spain randomly. And anyway, I met a girl that was studying conservation, and it just seemed the complete logical thing to do for me. And so then I went and researched what I needed to do. You have to have an undergraduate, and the undergraduate could be in art, or so it has to be some way practical. You have to have some kind of hand skills, you have to have some kind of art historical background, and you have to have basic science, so at least a GCSE in science. But you could come from a science degree or PhD and go into conservation, which would be amazing. There were only two places in England that you could study paper conservation for a master's. And I landed on London because that's where my family is. And just a side mention that that programme has just shut this year. I think it's taking its last year of students. So I don't know what the heritage sector is going to do in the future, because there'll be one programme in the whole of the UK for paper conservation. It was a two-year course. It gives you a really good opportunity to hone your hand skills. If you don't have the hand skills, you're in big trouble. And there's a lot of things that I remember thinking, I don't know how I'm going to do that. And there's things like backing removal. So quite often my work involves removing things that people did in sort of Victorian era to the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And that was when mid-1800s, in the Industrial Revolution, mass production came in, machine-made paper came in, and it wasn't this good quality handmade paper that you come across. There was a lot of acids in the paper, and collectors often bought artwork, which, say it was an old master, 15th century, which is beautiful paper, and then they'd mount it onto some really acidic cheap paper and put it in their album, let's say. And so through the years, this acidity that comes from the paper will migrate into the good quality paper and cause really bad problems like discoloration, foxing, and it could also break down the cellulose, so it become brittle. But anyway, my job oftentimes is to mechanically remove this backing. So it could be that I could have to be using a scalpel, it's a very sharp knife, with the object face down, removing this backing really slowly. So it could take 15 hours of time to remove one backing, and you'd be removing it to the very last layer, and then you'd probably use water, or depending on the media on the object, on the front of the object. If you can't use water, then you would be paring it down all the way down with a scalpel. So anyway, hand skills, that's what I was saying. So hand skills.
It sounds painstaking.
It's very, well, we were talking about that before, it's the sublime and the very boring. So you're working on the most amazing objects oftentimes, but you're having to really be careful, because you can lapse, your concentration can lapse if you're doing something mundane, but as soon as your concentration lapses, then you're endangering the object, so you just have to pace yourself. So doing an MA is you're learning the material sciences, you're learning the history, you're learning about pigments and colour, and you're really honing your hand skills by doing this kind of thing over and over again. As I mentioned previously, when I was living in Spain, when I heard about conservation, I met my now husband, And when I did my MA, I decided to split up the two-year program into 3 years and move to America for a year to be with him, as he's American. And I got to spend 1 year, I think it was a Crest scholarship, and I managed to spend a year working in the New York Botanical Gardens.
Oh,
and
wow.
In the paper conservation, so I got a scholarship there, and the Brooklyn Museum of Art. And again, having that extra year really enhanced my master's. So I land, 3 years later with my MA in paper conservation. I don't think anyone goes into conservation thinking they're going to make a lot of money. It's not very well paid. There aren't that many jobs, and generally when you start out, it's a lot of temporary contracts.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky if you can do a temporary contract, if you haven't got a mortgage or, you haven't got kids, which I didn't have at the time. So I managed to bounce around doing a lot of temporary contracts, but on reflection it was an amazing thing to do because I got to work in a lot of institutions in London and get a lot of experience working on different kinds of artwork, and it was a real privilege. And I think my best thing that I remember, I worked for a year at the British Museum, and when you go in the morning you get this enormous set of keys like Harry Potter land, and you just used to let yourself through the doors at the empty British Museum with this massive set of keys, opening them as you went through to get through to the paper conservation studio. That was my highlight of working there, but it was lovely. I eventually left London and moved down south, found myself at the RPM, and I'd never worked in a historic property before, so that's a different string to my bow, let's say. And most of the staff, I serve Brighton Pavilion, Brighton Museum, Hove Museum, Preston Manor and the Booth Museum where required.
Wow.
And most of my time is taken up with Brighton Museum, actually. Most of my work is exhibition based, so that means that I generally work with the fine art curator at least twice a year. And so we've got one dedicated prints and drawing gallery in Brighton Museum. Mm-hmm. So I work on that. And we usually try and have about 3 months to 6 months, ideally lead-in time, where I work with the curator, we select the objects, and that's always lovely, and work on layout. I look at the objects that we're selecting, and we'll make recommendations depending on the condition and the amount of work required to treat the object, how much the curator wants to exhibit an object, how vulnerable the object is to light exposure, assessing it, so looking at it. I would surface clean it using a light brush or a chemical sponge, it's called a smoke sponge, to remove sooty deposits. And also if there's heavy staining or heavy discoloration on the object, I might use solvents, or I might wash the print in a bath of water. Then I also mount and frame the objects where required. So in the Prints and Drawings Gallery, wonderfully, it's magnetic cases. So you just mount your object in the window mounts and add magnets to the back, and they just stick onto the side of the case, so that's rather nice. But still, all these things, I have to add up the amount of hours that would take me, and each of those exhibitions, so in the very small Prints and Drawings Gallery, there's about 40 objects per exhibition, so could take a day per object to work on.
It sounds like, as well, when you're talking, the fun bit about picking out the objects, that's quite a creative endeavour, that bit, I guess. I mean, I know you're providing almost the scientific perspective on it, like that's going to take that long because it needs this much work, but it sounds like there's I like the collaborative effort.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about this place, definitely, because there aren't that many of us and we have to go a long way. The Prints and Drawings collection, maybe only 50% of it's been catalogued. I don't know what the percentage is, but it seems to me that a lot of it is not catalogued, so a lot of it isn't available for people to research or view or know about. I'm pretty familiar with what's in the collection now, and the curator certainly is, but it's really exciting when we sort of think about things that we could exhibit and show that have never been seen before. So it's lovely. That that's the usual sort of what I'm doing for the Brighton Museum. But at the moment, I've got something a little bit different that I've just finished. We had some difficulties in Brighton Museum last year with the environment and the temperature. We decided in discussion with everybody that we would take a year where we didn't take any loans in. Often that's another element of my job, dealing with condition checking objects that we borrow from other institutions for exhibition. We decided that we wouldn't borrow anything in and we would just use our own objects. So in collaboration with programming, I suggested that we exhibit some of our Japanese woodcut collection, and they are absolutely beautiful. And again, a very small percentage of them have been exhibited or catalogued. So hopefully an outcome for this would be that someone will come in and spend some time cataloguing them. But anyway, that was taken on, and I've just spent the last 6 months working on that as well. So there's about 94 Japanese woodcuts, and they're being installed right now.
This did get mentioned the other day by Jodie East, actually, the Japanese woodcuts, but I don't think we got to the bottom exactly of why Brighton Museum has so many Japanese woodcuts. Do you happen to know?
No. So nobody knows. All I came across when they were in my workshop, I was treating them, and again, like I said, with these collectors that they'd stuck them on these really acidic backings, and I was looking at those, and they had collector's stamps on a lot of them, which I've cut out and preserved so that when they get to do the cataloguing, they'll have all their information. But the collector's stamp referred to a really, I don't know what the word is, huge, amazing collector of Japanese prints in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he donated supposedly all of his collection to the British Museum, which is why they've got such a phenomenal woodcut, Japanese woodcut collection. So possibly we got the duplicates, or we got the ones that he found in the bottom of the box.
Mm.
Ideally, we could have someone from the British Museum to come and have a look. I think all of theirs are catalogued and all of theirs are available online. So it just takes someone to have some time to do that.
Mm.
But I don't know why, but it's lovely. And I think I suggested it on a whim and it got picked up, and I think everyone's been very enthusiastic about it. The only thing is that there hasn't been input from the fine art curator on sort of the more academic context to the collection. And I think this is sort of, I think it's fine. I think you can go into a gallery and look at things and appreciate them and think they're beautiful. And because we don't have a lot of time and there aren't enough people, I think maybe that's okay. But there is sort of a thought that a lot of exhibitions have to be scholarly and you have to learn from them.
Mm.
But I think it's a good compromise, and we'll see what people think. Those are the elements of, you know, my day-to-day churn. So I'll always have an exhibition on the go. Several times a year we have loans out, so that's when other institutions are having exhibitions and they want to borrow something of ours. And usually, again, it'll either be a conservator or a curator that will go with the object. So we'll do any treatment, the borrowing institution will pay for our time, and if things need reframing or remounting, then they'll pay for that. So it's a really good opportunity. I'm always a big fan of exhibitions and loaning because it means that people get to view and use our collection.
Yeah.
Not really a fan of keeping it all away from people. The painting collection gets borrowed out a lot more because it's available on the public catalogue, so people actually know what we've got.
Right.
Whereas ours is works on paper, is a little bit more mysterious. But usually a couple of times a year that happens, and if the work is very straightforward, then we'll try and find another institution to oversee our objects. So we've just loaned a painting and two works on paper to a touring exhibition in New Zealand. So none of us went to New Zealand.
Well, that's a shame.
I know. But often you do. We had a constable that went to New York last year or the year before. And because that's such a major part of our collection, a feather in our cap, one of the staff members went along with the object just to oversee how they look after it. To double check, you know, how they install the objects. So she got a trip to New York. I did not.
So I hadn't totally grasped the fact that you look after them for all of those different sites. So yeah. There was me busy thinking about all the paper-based items in the Royal Pavilion.
Yeah.
But actually, there you've said, no, Brighton Museum's where I...
You know, it all averages out, but I try and do the disaster day, and then the other half day is the pavilion, so that I actually give the pavilion some love. You know, we have a closed week every year, so mm-hmm. we spend 1 week with no members of the public, cleaning and dusting and doing all the projects that we've wanted to do, but just take too long to... I mean, I never knew when I took the job that I'd be up, you know, 20 foot, well, I don't know if 20 foot high, but really high scaffolding and these genies and getting my steel toe cap boots and stuff like that. But it's very varied. And when we did the saloon project, which opened last year, again, there's often times where everybody is on hand, and we were all there before they applied the platinum to the walls. We were all there with our little agate burnishers, so it's a little stick with a bit of polished agate stone on the end of it, all burnishing the walls. They're only about a centimetre wide, so very small little things, and all of us were there rubbing the walls to make them smooth and shiny. So hours, a week, I think, everybody rubbing different parts to make the walls smooth and shiny.
It sounds really quite fun.
Yeah, sometimes it's fun. So this week I was thinking on the way here, okay, well, this week I hefted 94 frames over to the museum. So you think about that as well when you've got all the sites, you've got all the practicalities of getting things between the sites. I wondered if when I had the job interview that they looked me over like a cart horse and thought, she'll last a few years, she'll be all right. Because you have to be really physically fit as well for the job. You have to be, you know, climbing up ladders, carrying things. There is no one to help. There's no one to help you. Sounds so sad. But, you know, between us, we got the trolleys, we hefted things up the back of where I work on in the pavilion, and then trundled, you know, 4 or 5 trips back and forth between the museum with all of these beautiful Japanese prints, got them in the lifts and then hefted them out. So that was one day, laid them out in the museum, and then we have a team who would do the installation, so putting them up on the wall. So that was a couple of days this week. And then this morning I was dusting. So I was vacuuming and dusting the staircases in the pavilion, because to clean up the building, dust it and take all the protective covers off everything and make sure it looks beautiful for the press launch tomorrow. So
right.
It's a lovely team. I mean, it's a really lovely team. But there's and the person in charge of preservation is unstoppable.
So I guess that's what you need.
You really do need it. Yeah, you do. But so the pavilion, I will do what needs to do. So we have so many visitors that come around the building. Quite often paper gets scuffed up or ripped a little bit on the walls. So I will go and clean that up where need be. And we also have a few areas where artwork is hung, so I will keep an eye on that and ask and try and have a rotation period for the works that are displayed. And we also have a temporary exhibition gallery in the pavilion, so again, when it's decided that will be rotated, then that's usually the majority of that works on paper. But there are wonderful things in the pavilion, and I mean, again, I was talking about the British Museum, that a lot of us in conservation preservation go in very early to work every morning. So we usually start about 7 because nobody's there because the building's shut. And it's just wonderful walking through the pavilion when nobody's there. And you can sort of imagine how it would have been, you know, back in the day. It's just it's a privilege. But there's so many sort of little hidden nooks and crannies there in the pavilion with all these domes, and a lot of them are storerooms. The curator of the pavilion calls them oubliettes. So they're little domes that people forget about. So there's just stuff in them. But there's a really wonderful area, and it's called the saloon bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've spent a bit of time over the last year clearing that out. It's a little bit hairy because the staircase is coming away from the wall. to get up to it. But Tim, the keeper of the building, has had it surveyed and it is safe, but you can't go up in big groups and you have to walk up the spiral staircase very close to the wall as you go up, not to put pressure on the outside. But it's a very, very large spiral staircase and you get up to the saloon bottle. And it was said that that was supposed to be George's billiards room.
Right.
I can't imagine that he would have got up there. And then I think it was a valet's bedroom. This sort of circular suite of rooms, sort of two main areas. And they've got the, I don't know what they're called, like the star windows all the way around, because it's one of these bottles, these onion skins. It's got windows all around the exterior. It sort of looks either romantic or like a horror movie, but it's sort of like, God, sort of, it did have just sort of junk up there and broken things. And it has some collection material stored up there. And it has all this Victorian wallpaper that some of it's falling down, some of it's not, a lot of it's faded. It's all extremely dirty. So that was one of my sort of missions in the pavilion, that we've cleared it out. So it's now just dirty, but it's all the collection objects, so that's sort of half pilasters and stuff from the banqueting room. We know they're there and they're all catalogued, and then there's no more junk, and all the windows have been fitted with blinds so that they can be pulled down so that the wallpaper doesn't get any more damaged.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and then the next step is Tim's going to get the ceiling checked to make sure it's safe, because at the moment it's hard hats, and then after that I can clean and catalogue or document the wallpaper. Ideally we'd love to have groups up there, but I think we can have very small groups up there, but there's limited, I think there's, you can escape across the roof or something, but I think it's just a bit with the stairs and everything, it's quite difficult. But it's sort of wonderful. I think when you watch the video, when you visit the Royal Pavilion, there is a video showing that room. But there's sort of a few areas like that in the pavilion that are really sort of on my wish list, that one of the days that I will work on. And but most of the time it's just a bit of first aid where it's needed around the building. And my area of interest is the Adelaide corridor, which is upstairs. I don't know if you've seen it. It's outside the tea room. And that is really significant because it is the only thing in the whole pavilion that never moved. It was installed, and then when, you know, this all the stuff happened with Victoria and everything was carted off to London, that did not move, and that was saved by the fact that it was stuck directly onto the plaster, which has been its saviour and its sort of death sentence, maybe, at the same time. And then there was a curator, and I think he varnished everything and with this very thick yellow varnish, which again sort of saved it. But it also sort of infused into the paper. But he thought it was a way of protecting it, but obviously with age it went very brittle and very dark. His children used to cycle up and down the corridor, you know, in the pavilion. So at the moment it's in such an, well, it would never be moved, but it's in quite an awkward corridor. And so the access, because people have to get to the cafe, it's behind this sort of glazing that was installed, and then no one's opened it for the last 15 years. But my predecessor did remove one of the sections of the wallpaper and conserved it, and it looks amazing. But I think it was terrifying and very stressful, and she sort of said, never touch it. But I am very tempted, and I think that we need to make more of this wallpaper because it's wonderful. And it's Chinese wallpaper, Chinese export wallpaper, but it's unusual because it's a dragon boat racing and a hunting scene. So, and you can date it by the scene. It was obviously bought and then shown to George. I don't know which way around it happened, but there were two rolls of it with exactly the same theme. And the other one is in this, like a summer palace in the Netherlands. And I went to visit a friend and went and visited this little summer palace. And they got a lot of money, I think by UNESCO, don't know who, and it's been conserved beautifully. And you can, and again, it's a room, it's all four sides, so you can walk around the room and see this narrative going around it. And wow, it looks really fresh and it looks really beautiful and it's really inspiring and it's wonderful. this dark, dingy corridor that we have ours in is not so ideal. And the building must have looked, I mean, it all, now we've got the Royal Loans in, it's sort of overwhelming now with all the stuff in it. And you think upstairs, because apparently off the Adelaide corridor was this spiral staircase that went down to George, it still is there, but like a private office bedroom, so he could nip upstairs and see whoever was upstairs. It's a spiral staircase, and that was plastered with small vignettes of sort of Chinese scenes, apparently. We've never found them, and apparently there's records of that being plastered with overlapping sort of small Chinese prints. So it must have been just overwhelming. So the corridor was probably just a dazzling sort of thing you walk through. Oh, we could make a lot more of it, so. Mm.
This building is just so complicated and rich and delicate and bonkers.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And it's just, and I wanted to ask you, what's been the most unexpected thing about working at RPM? Or what have you, kind of, what's the thing that you've come to really appreciate that you didn't expect before? Because it seems like this is unlike any other paper conservation job anywhere in the UK, by the sounds of things.
Probably. I think the culmination was, I can't remember how many years ago, say a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago when I arrived at work and there were like zebras in the front of the pavilion because we were a film set for the week for a film. I think it's out now. It's called This Current War.
Oh,
and
right.
So we spent the week, we'd shut down the pavilion for their fee, and we were, all of conservation were there to oversee the filming, and they wanted the banqueting room. They arrived with there were zebras and horses and stuff wandering around at the front, and then a carriage arrived, and then inside the pavilion it was Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm.
Yeah, and he was doing this scene over and over again in the banqueting room. And in one of the shots, there was a walking shot with the cameras, and they wanted all of us. So there's, I mean, the crew for a film, there's just thousands of them. And then we had the security staff sort of on hand. And then there was a team of conservation who was sort of dotted around to make sure people didn't lean on the walls or get the equipment in the way.
Just
to make
it a stressful job.
Because and it's also quite scary having to stand up to these people, because they're very busy, their time is money, and they want to do the things they want to do, and they don't like hearing no. So there was a lot of that, and there were just so many of them doing, you know, all these whatever they're doing, sound and filming. But anyway, there was one of the scenes that they wanted to do a walking shot, so they strapped the camera onto them, and they just said they had to clear the room, and they wanted everyone out except the actors. And I had to say, no, there has to be someone from, we can't just leave you in the room like this somewhere. So I had to sort of crouch along in front of the camera, like crawling along, and then hide behind a door when they were filming. So I just thought, well, how did this happen? Like, this is not the job I thought I was going to have. So I think I just spring from it that it's really varied. And every time we sort of say, oh, well, it won't be like this again, it always is like that again. There's always something, you know, with the saloon project where just, you know, there was just so much with that. And then the Royal Loans, we've got these millions of exhibitions. And I just think, well, you know, who knows what's next?
If we were thinking about the future now of RPM, as a paper conservator, what do you most hope for? If you could have the wish list for the next few years.
So myself, the Object Conservator and the Painting Conservator, we all started 5 years ago. And I think it's taken us, I mean, Stig and I started painting and paper. We started 2.5 days a week. I think it's taken us this long to sort of grab the carriage by the reins and whoa. So I think we would really like there to be less big projects and more day-to-day planning and maintenance, taking care of what we've got. I think as much as all these wonderful things are so exciting, we'd just like it to be a bit boring for a bit, really, and just get our jobs done and not be herring around. And I think everybody would say this throughout the organisation, but a bit more planning, a bit more strategic planning, and a bit more notice so we can resource better for projects. But, you know, if you ask me in a couple of years and it has got all boring, who knows how I'll feel about it.
Yeah, you're stamping up and down saying, I want more temporary exhibitions.
Yeah, and... I mean, maybe we will, we did say we need to, you know, I think it's on the collections trust, we need to use our collection, we need to show our collection, we need to stop. Bringing in touring exhibitions from other institutions is great, but we have a fabulous collection ourselves, so I think we need to advocate, you know, be proud of what we do and be proud of what we've got and do it well, do it properly.
I think that thing about more day-to-day planning is kind of, it's a really undervalued call to, you know, it's important. I think it's very important.
Yeah.
Just that time to like, look after what you've got. I think
yeah.
Is there one paper item that is your that you absolutely love to death that is like your is the thing, or is there one collection that you really are?
Oh God, no. I mean, it's wonderful. It's all wonderful. You know, some days I've got the best job ever. The collection is gorgeous. The wallpaper is just beautiful if you go and look at it. But it's, you know, getting to suggest the Japanese woodcut exhibition and that being taken on by someone who knows how to do an exhibition and curate it was wonderful. Because we do have, you know, we don't have a lot of old masters, but we have got some old masters. We've got some 15th century, you know, European prints, which are beautiful. We have Indian miniatures, we've got Chinese drawings. So we've got a lot of things we can and should showcase. We'll just see how this is received and what people, you know, who the visitors are and what they want to see.
In terms of the role of RPM within Brighton and Hove, do you think at the moment that it's playing as much role as it could do within the city in terms of its collection? Do you think the people of Brighton recognise the value of it?
It's really hard. I don't know. I personally think that maybe it's a bit dumbed down. I think their audience is more, I don't know who their audience is, but I perceive that their audience is far more sort of can take on a lot more than is being offered.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to you know, as a conservator, is to make things last forever and to look after them as best as possible. So everything's on offer for me. All I can advocate is a wonderful collection. I think there's an intelligence audience. Brighton has a really sort of diverse population. I think we could do a lot more, a lot better.
Mm.
But, you know.
But like you said, you're kind of there at the foundation point.
Yeah.
Making sure it's available anyway.
Yeah.
You've given me a lot of rich stuff that I'm going to have to think, how are we going to order this? But thank you.
Thanks. Oh, pleasure.
Another person whose job it is to make things last forever is Carola Del Meze, who was an intern at the Royal Pavilion last year working on metal conservation. I found her in one of the strange pavilion oubliettes that Amy mentioned in her interview.
Can you describe where we are?
When you look at the front of the pavilion, the entrance to the pavilion, there's a number of onion domes kind of at first, first story level. This room is, I think, officially known as the Juppery, and we're inside the Onion Dome on the right-hand side. It's full of chemicals and paints and equipment and some incredibly beautiful pieces of sort of gilt work in among these big piles of
other crap. It's quite a beautiful and weird room, basically, and it feels like... Yeah, well, it feels like a studio, I guess.
I've been here for the last 3 months on my own. I call it my ivory tower. I love it, actually. I'm Carola. I am currently an intern in the conservation department here. I will be going on to start a postgraduate in conservation of historical objects with a specialisation in metalwork. So over the summer here at RPM, I've been working on the silver gilt collection of the banqueting suite, which was in need of cleaning. So I've been using a couple of different techniques to clean things, and then we are lacquering things so that stabilizes the object and stops any further tarnishing, and it should be effective for about 10-15 years, something like that. silver is the substrate metal. Gilt always means that the substrate material is covered in a very thin layer of gold. So you can get anything gilded, basically. And this is silver gilt. So these objects are two very ornate, beautiful fruit stands. Every single item in the banqueting suite is so beautiful, so intricately made. But it's all kind of lost when you go in there because there's so much amazing craftsmanship in that room that if you don't look at an individual fruit stand.
This is the banqueting hall in the Royal Pavilion,
exactly,
right? Like the big sort of centrepiece with the big gold palm tree thing coming from the ceiling.
See, exactly, you're describing the palm trees, the beautiful ceiling, the dragons everywhere, the beautiful Chinese like wall coverings, and then on the all around the side and the table that goes down the middle, you've got this dinner suite, silver, and some of it's ormolu, which is brass covered in gold, so that's brass gilt.
Right.
But a lot of it is solid silver, and these items are pretty heavy, really three-dimensional fruit, like tiny like swathes and swags of fruit with these beautiful little kind of puck god type
look like Neptune type kind of
character. Yeah, well, they've got these horns, and then above that there's these three women who are holding these rods, and then on the top of their heads there's this bowl which has got beautiful ivy leaves, and ivy is ivy and oak are a bit of a theme going throughout the whole dinner display. So the fruit then goes into this really complex bowl. And everything just comes apart into its pieces so that it can be cleaned and washed. And they're just amazing, beautiful items. There are pieces downstairs that were left over from the French Revolution. And for instance, last week, actually, I cleaned a really beautiful engraved silver gilt, again, tray that was from the early 1700s. Cleaned that. That's going to an exhibition in San Francisco, I believe. Tray made by a guy called Valadier. Kind of blown away by how beautiful the items
are. Yeah. Does it feel weird to be so intimate with such precious objects?
You know, it really does.
Yeah.
I love it. I think that the people that commissioned these, you know, George and the rich people that ate out of them, probably didn't really look at them that much, that closely. So I feel as if, because I'm looking at these things really carefully, because I have to make sure there's no tarnish, and I've written down all the scratches and which bits are bent, and some of them haven't got, you know, bits missing and all this kind of stuff, that I've come really, probably as close to them as the original maker has. When you hear conservators talking, that they say the same thing, that they feel really intimate with the objects that they have spent like weeks and months conserving. So I now know what that feels like, and it's really, in a very small way, it's really cool.
You're part of this fellowship of the craftspeople. It's amazing, over the centuries.
I am a metalworker myself, so what's really interesting is looking at the things and then going, oh, well, that's how they made that, or that bit was made a bit sloppily, or finding little tiny scratches, or where they put like marks, and you can see where parts of the mould were, and yeah, how things are made is always, always interested in me. So
yeah,
so I love this. So I actually found a 1-year postgraduate diploma in conservation of historical objects, but with a specialisation in metalwork. Now, I'm going to West Dean College, so I applied, got funding. I haven't got all the funding I need, but I'm just going to make that happen. I'm just going to believe that it's going to happen, and, you know, keep my nose to the grindstone. And they only do conservation courses. Again, they've got one in musical instruments, paper, ceramics, metalwork, tapestry, a couple of other things. And luckily that's in Chichester, which is just down the road from Brighton. So I will be going there for a year. That's a full-time course. And then after that, you can carry on, do another year and make it an MA. And that's really what you need, as I understand it, to begin your career as a conservator. The demographic for conservators is 97% white middle-class women over 40, which means it's a second career mainly for most conservators. And by that time, by the time you're that 40, if you're going to go into conservation, you know what you're really, really interested in. Like, I know I'm really interested in ancient metalwork, and that's so niche that maybe before people kind of did... I would have loved if there'd been an apprenticeship. I think learning on the job is really just invaluable, but there aren't any apprenticeships in this kind of thing at the moment.
So just talk us quickly through ancient metal, what that is.
History and prehistory is divided up of when the Romans came, is when things were written about. So before the Romans arrived, people didn't write down history, they didn't write what happened. And so I guess it's really before that I'm interested in. And I will freely admit that when I start my course, I think your interests kind of can change and mm-hmm. you focus on more things and stuff. But I've always been really interested in hoards that get found, brought up from, why are they there? What are they about? And archaeology, it's because archaeology is essentially mainly guesswork. Mm. Like, some of these objects are like, what even are they? They bring them up from the ground. They're like things in the Staffordshire Hoard that they don't know what they are. But they're so beautiful. They're so intricately made. This kind of almost pure gold with these beautiful garnets that are just made into this scintillating, these beautiful items that you're thinking, well, actually, that's... So I'm just talking about Staffordshire Hoard, that's not prehistory, that's like Saxon. Things that are brought up out of the ground, I've got to say, are probably the things that really interest me. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of detective work around them, and I kind of like that, piecing things together and cleaning things, and then you see the object and you think, oh my God, well, it could have been this, or let's find out if there was anything else that was... Oh, look, this looks like it's that come off a helmet, or what I mean? There's so much guesswork that I think it's the kind of discovery, I think, that I love about it. When you bring things up out of the ground, the organic stuff is usually not there anymore. And I think that's maybe what I like about metal, is that it's still the thing that's there. Mm. And glass, I guess, and ceramic.
What's your favourite thing about the Royal Pavilion?
Favourite item or just...
anything.
Okay, so each room is different. You just walk into each room and you go, oh, wow, like this room is like a weird like casino lounge, or this room is like a really bizarre room in a computer game. Oh, this is like a toilet, this is like the Queen's toilet. There's like a room that's the Queen's toilet. Everything is just covered. I mean, it's just... I know I keep going on about it, but the craftsmanship involved... I mean, I think it took something like 11... Don't quote me exactly on this, but 11 years to regild the inside of the dome in the music room. The guy that did it, Norman, is a really amazing guy. I think he said there's something like 32,000 or 35,000 of these shapes that he had to gild.
Wow. Yeah. Where's Norman now?
Norman retired, just...
It seems possible afterwards.
But he's still... I did a little 2-day gilding course with him earlier this summer. So he's still... I think he just works privately for... He just works freelance now.
That's great. Oh, cool. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to press stop now. But thanks, Carola. Really good to talk to you.
Thank you.
My sincere thanks to Amy and Carola for talking about conservation at the Royal Pavilion. While I love what Amy said about her work veering between the sublime to the very boring, something we've heard before about museum work from Chris Drake at Preston Manor in Series 1, I was also in awe of the high level of craftsmanship involved in conservation, as described by Carola. Nevertheless, it was disconcerting to hear that higher education courses in conservation are increasingly under threat. How can we continue to preserve our collections if we do not have enough learning opportunities and new students from diverse backgrounds trained in the art of conservation? This will be even more the case in life post-pandemic. A survey undertaken by the Institute of Conservation at the start of lockdown expressed the uncertainty felt by conservators, many of whom have lost work or had it postponed, with regards to the future economic health of heritage organisations, which they anticipate will detrimentally affect future budgets for conservation in museums. This is doubly worrying at a time when so many institutions have had to close their buildings and sites at short notice, leaving the objects and collections in their care at risk. Join me next time, where I'll be talking to curator Dr. Alexandra Loske about A Prince's Treasure, the substantial loan of decorative art and furniture from the Royal Collection at Buckingham Palace, made to the Royal Pavilion last year and recently reopened to the public.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at oneby1.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums are supported by the oneby1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts. Lo-Fi.